Hi everyone, this is your host Liz. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. This podcast is a platform for real-life stories and career journeys of people living in New York City. On today's episode, we have Christian Krastev as our guest. He's the executive manager of Dudley's NYC. Christian and his family came from Bulgaria to pursue a better life in New York City and has been a go-getter ever since he turned 18. As a well-known hard worker in the New York City restaurant industry, it was only fitting to have him as our guest on the podcast. This is Realistically with Liz. Hi, Christian. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. So let's just dive right in with when did you move to New York City?
I moved to New York City in 1997, an immigrant coming from Bulgaria through an immigrant lottery system that my parents won.
So what, do you mind explaining what was that lottery system? Yeah, like what was that about?
Basically, think about a lottery, one out of 100 families in 12 million got it, and New York was the next destination to live and, make your journey. And that was about it. Here.
So how old were you when you moved to New York?
I was five and a half.
Okay, so really young. Do you remember anything about like when you first moved here? Like what did that like feel like being so young?
You know, you're a kid, you don't know much. You know, I do remember it all because it was still a shock in the system, and you know, you just didn't know the language, you know, it was you're talking to kids in a different language at the park and no one's really playing with you. So I knew something was off, but things quickly changed once kindergarten and first grade came around.
So where did you and your family live for the first couple of years where you were in New York?
We started in Manhattan. We actually lived in the Bulgarian Orthodox Church. They took all the green card residents who essentially won the lottery just to kind of give them a 3-month, kind of ground to start off. And then after that, you kind of found your way. Most Bulgarians moved into Queens, others moved into South Brooklyn. And that's kind of where my story started. And, South Brooklyn, Diker Heights, Bensonhurst, that's usually my area that everything, my childhood began.
So pretty far out in Brooklyn. I think that those are two neighborhoods that probably a lot of people haven't heard of if they didn't grow up here, let alone if they've lived here a couple of years, just because they're really far. I think, you know, anybody that's listening, if you ever have been to New York and you probably took the train to Coney Island, that you've definitely probably gone by one of those areas, haven't probably experienced them, but have definitely gone by them.
Yeah, Bensonhurst it's a trek. It's the stop before Coney Island, essentially. And but it's where, you know, it's one of the most populated areas in Brooklyn, and it's very diverse, and it holds homes for a lot of families.
So did you go to Coney Island a lot when you grew up, like that, since you were so close? Was that kind of like your little escape from like school, let's say, and just like being at home?
Coney Island, for sure. We have our own, like, it's Caesar's Bay, that's what we call it, which is essentially the path under the Verrazano Bridge. So that is, I think it's like a 2-3 mile kind of trek, which kind of leads you at the other end where the Statue of Liberty is. So, you know, whether it was Coney Island, whether it was Caesars Bay or kind of Bay Ridge in general, it's in that vicinity of, you know, South Brooklyn that we were hanging out, and we didn't trek into Prospect Park or, you know, other neighborhoods because, you know, it's different years and those neighborhoods weren't populated and kind of where they are now.
Yeah. So really, really interesting. So let's talk about where you went to school, and what was your first job?
Hunter College. Hunter College is a city college. It's in the Midtown in the 60s in Lex. First job wise, I started work the summer right before college started. So I was 17 and a half, you know, I'm a later baby, I'm in September, so, you know, I had just, 17 and a half, and I had 3 copies of that resume that basically had absolutely nothing besides, you know, a few little, side works here and there, but I took those three copies of the resume into Broadway of Soho, right off the M train off Prince. And with those three copies, I walked into three stores: Hugo Boss, Guess, Quiksilver. And Guess was the lucky charm out of those three. And I got hired the same day and started training the next morning right after that.
Yeah, so seems pretty quick. I mean, you just said you started like the next day, like you started training. So you really must have charmed them, as you said, during your interview process. I mean, we've had a lot of guests on the podcast that have worked in retail, myself included. I think what's interesting here is that you said you only had three copies of your resume. So one, you were very limited, unless you were planning on, you know, stopping at a Staples and, you know, printing more out, or maybe it was just you were going to go like the next day and hit up more stores. But it seemed like you really just gave yourself a goal to walk into three different places that really like called out, you know, for like your name, that called out your name for like an opportunity. Wouldn't you agree?
I definitely had the full intention of knowing that I was going to get something. I didn't know what it was. But I was very one confident to, I knew something was going to come out of this, you know, as far as my work ethic, my availability, you know, it was summertime. I had nothing else to do besides give my full attention to work. And, I had my full attention to keep working throughout college because I was staying in and, I needed to make money anyways. But I knew that I was going to get a job no matter where I was. But I knew I wanted to be in Soho. That was number one. And then I didn't really know where and what I wanted to do at that point in time.
Yeah. I mean, Soho is definitely like a hot spot, not just for retail, but in general, there's so many businesses there and opportunities. But I think that everything that you just said, it sounds that you come from a working family. Just having that determination and, you know, taking a risk like that, just saying like, I'm not going to go home till I find a job today, even if it's just with three resumes.
Yeah. I actually, you know, funny thing was that I was going for, Uniqlo was just opening. It was their first week or two. So this is 2010, I believe. And, there was like group calls. And I actually never made it across the street to Uniqlo. And nor did I have any more resumes because I had, stayed on that right side of the Prince Street where Hugo Boss hit me first. I, pretty much got rejected very quickly for not having experience. A guest pretty much told me that I'm hired tomorrow, but I have one more. And I just went across the street, and Quiksilver was right there after the bank too. And Quiksilver also wanted me to start the next day. But the whole point of the story is that I was kind of going for Uniqlo at that time, where it was the shop to be at. That year of, I knew I was going to get hired there because they needed workers in a new, retail location.
Yeah. I think Uniqlo definitely is one. It's such a large corporation. And when it hit the city too, it was, I think it just took the city by storm. Like I remember being here and seeing the ads on the subway for the Heat Tech product, which to this day, I still wear it. Like it's just, plus their stores are massive and they're super organized and, everything is like done to perfection. So I can imagine like that they had like a pretty large staff. So, as you mentioned, group calls, which one are never really, really fun to do, are mostly like group interviews that retailers have, which I have experienced too, which also happened at Soho. I went to a group interview at Topshop, actually, RIP, when it still existed in the US.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was just, I think it was what I remember. It was just like really weird because obviously you just need to pitch yourself to one person in a typical interview.
That was really it. And guess it was just the hiring manager, I guess men's manager at the time. And it was just him and I, because I caught him in that men's section, I think it was. And, I gave him a resume. He said, "Where have you worked?" I said, "Absolutely nowhere, but I want to work. This is my first summer." And, he threw me on. And, minimum wage, three shifts a week, it was the best job I think I've ever had. And I had the most fun with it at 17 and a half. You can't really ask for more. Working with, 30-plus-year-olds who are... And guess, was not... it's not... I don't want to say it's like entry level. It's still... People really wanted to work at Guess, and they were opening up a lot of locations. So I kind of just went in there and shocked the system, of working and had a great time.
Yeah. I mean, well, 10 years ago, I think retail was definitely booming. So, you know, even to use a brand like Guess, I mean, Guess has been around for hundreds of years and has had faces from like everywhere, from like everyone, excuse me, from like Jennifer Lopez to like Gigi Hadid on their ads.
I think Kate Upton on the
Kate Upton
fifth,
yeah.
for the Fifth Avenue opening.
Yeah.
They had her there for the signing and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
And,
they have,
you know,
really
it was big.
Big.
It was definitely a big procedure.
Yeah, definitely like large marketing campaigns
very
for advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's really interesting that, you know, as a male, you saw yourself, you know, with the opportunity of like, hey, I'm going to go and get a retail job. You know, you're very strategic in a sense that, you know, you grew up in Brooklyn. You chose to stay in the city to go to college, you know, just because one, it would be more cost effective, but at the same time to be close to your family. So I think that that's, you know, really, really important.
Yeah, for me, I was going to the city every day, so I might as well find work and, you know, kind of head straight to school right afterwards. And I didn't want to stay in Brooklyn too much, so, you know, besides residentially living there, but work-wise, I knew where the money was at, and that was being in the city,
yeah.
No matter what you were doing.
So let's go back. You mentioned that you went to Hunter for undergraduate. So what did you study at Hunter? And, you know, what did you think your, like, what did you go into Hunter thinking that your job would be post-college?
Hunter College, I went into the biology major. Biology meaning that I was going to be a doctor or some kind of doctoral form. I don't want to say that I didn't like it. I did very well. I was 4.0 till about my third year in. So, you know, I was, you know, whether it was microbiology or any of these calculus, you know, four, any of these like very difficult classes that normally struggled, I never really struggled in them. But, you know, for me, it was that I didn't see a future in continuing what I was doing. So at that point in my about 2.5 to my 3 years of biology, which, you know, essentially you're pretty much done and have to choose your next role, you know, of what you're going to do after this. I kind of got to the point where I just, you know, saw a different path. Even though I was working, but, you know, I was really still into schoolwork and doing all that good stuff, I decided to just, you know, kind of step another foot to transfer was either psychology or sociology. You know, very similar but very different at the same time. And psychology was just kind of where, you know, my foot landed. You know, I did all those prereqs, but eventually my degree, even though it's an undergrad, it's kind of stated as behavioral psychology, where I walk and understand the concept of the human mind and how people work and how they think and how it affects their daily lives, which is kind of where my job now and plays a role of how I know who is what and what they're doing and what they'll be doing in the future. And that's it, you know, psychology just happened to be, you know, was there a point where I thought psychology could be an absolute future? And I, you know, I do, and you can always kind of go back to school if you want to, but I didn't see myself, you know, continually working with people, whether it's, you know, HR, in a form of HR, or even if I want to do medicine again, you know, psychiatry in another form of listening to people. I knew that the goal of all this was to work with people. You know, that was really it. You know, I couldn't be behind the desk on the phone or, you know, in front of a computer 24/7. I just knew that I worked best with people and listening to them and talking to them, guiding them and just having them, you know, express what they need to express, because they knew that I knew especially that I was the one that can help out in whatever form I can. And that's the psychiatry behind it all.
Did you, I mean, psychology is so different. Like, I don't even
totally,
know
yeah.
where to even go with that. But, you know, as someone that studied fashion, so I get the whole people part, which is, you know, why I have valued working in retail so much, because one, you get to know the people and it really teaches you the ins and the outs of like customer service. And I think that that's really what takes you far in your career, especially if you work in sales. So speaking of retail, so did you keep your job all 4 years in Hunter, or, you know, did things kind of change as, like, let's say maybe you got busier in school, or did you, you know, always make time to have a job?
No, I made sure that I worked 40 hours a week and went full-time to school. There was no question about it that I wasn't going to work full-time and not go to school full-time. So, you know, I really wanted to make both ends of the world happy, including obviously myself in it. But one, I had moved out when I was 18. So if you're saying 17 and a half was my first job, you know, about 3-4 months later, I already had moved out my parents. So, you know, living by myself, bills and kind of cleaning and growing up were things that I just had to adapt. But, you know, it made me the person who I am today, of course. But, you know, with the bills came rent. So, you know, you had to pay rent, you know, every month. That was a grown-up thing that I just had to accept. So, you know, I knew that, you know, 3 out of my 4 checks had to go to rent. So, you know, I made sure 40 hours a week was consistent at work, whether it was at one job or another job. And then obviously my full-time classes and summer classes and winter classes were a normal thing. You know, I guess just the retail, I kind of just started growing into retail. And, you know, I think my hard work kind of was just paying off. You know, they saw this young kid at 18 kind of stepping foot with full-time availability, nonstop, and actually caring about, you know, what he was doing too. You know, led me into opening up a few more guest stores. You know, I was just a basic kind of a men's denim lead, I guess you want to refer it to. Michael Kors then opened up on 5th Avenue on 49th and 5th. I was part of that opening team. And then I think that working there and once again being such a high volume store led me into Ted Baker and kind of how we met into that aspect. And me becoming at that point was my first managerial role of assistant men's manager of Ted Baker on 5th Avenue, and which was my last role, you know, in retail.
So it sounds like you were excelling pretty well in retail.
Very good, yeah.
You definitely had connections that, you know, were taking you places.
Everywhere,
not only
yeah.
with your sales performance, but clearly your people skills were helping you out as well.
And the cool thing about retail was that no one ever questioned my school, or no one ever, you know, because you were so hardworking. Your availability and everything was just, no one ever questioned if I was in school or what I was doing. For them, and obviously that they should, that's, you know, for them is that this person was here now and giving them all their hardest. Even on those two Tuesdays and Thursdays that I always needed off was a full day of school from 8 a.m. to, you know, 10 p.m. But that was just part of, you know, living it.
I think that brings up a valid point because when you go to look for a job in retail, at least, and in some other industries as well that are, you know, service-based industries, your resume is important, but it's more important in terms of experience than that little section that says your education. So whether or not, you know, you're working on your degree, whether it's like, you know, associate, bachelor, et cetera, you know, what other job experiences that you have from the past are really what they're taking into account. Plus, you know, again, you knowing already like the whole psychology background and like how you were studying people, like that was helping you too. That even like subconsciously you had that
everything
in the bag.
Everything played a role in it. You know,
yeah.
It's like school, and you know, people say, is this what you're doing now? Or did you learn anything from school? Everything I've learned from school was 100%, you know, kind of emphasized in work every day of, you know, life, you know, basically on the psychological aspect of things.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of when I went to school, you know, I think we've talked about this before, just like having a going for fashion, it's a little difficult to really see, you know, the tangible results of your work. So I think that's why I threw myself into retail as well, like during college, and also kind of did the same thing. I think towards my third and fourth year, it was really not that I did not care as much in school, but it was more of, okay, what's happening in the real world? How much am I, you know, it's a big responsibility when you have a job and you have to show up to a job, you know, and you're clocking in for, you know, whatever it is, 6 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours. It's not just about, you know, in this case for retail, it's not just about folding the clothes. It's really like, you know, if it's sales performance, someone else is, you know, grading your performance, that those numbers are worth like, you know, a store's weekly goal, a store's monthly goal, like whether the store is performing and the brand is performing, that's how you can excel. And that's how, you know, whether or not you want a future in that, you know, for the brand, for the company, that's really, you know, the what you need to be keeping in mind versus like, okay, I need to make sure that I get an A+ in this class, even though, yes, it's, it's still important because, you know, you want to make sure that you do end up getting your degree if you're already, you know, have done all that work.
Yeah, yeah. I think Ted Baker, just, I guess, adding on to that, was, it really was an eye-opener, because I got to the point where, you know, MODs was like a thing, you know, key, you know, locking up the restaurant, I mean, not the restaurant, excuse me, we're getting there, but locking up the actual store, you know, checking everyone, you know, kind of an LP scenario. So it really was like adding these like key things that, you know, I wasn't really asking for, but they were just like kind of, you know, meet, I forgot it, the main guy, the British guy who used to come all the time, you know, who checked up on things, you know. You know, but it was these small things of like headquarter people. I think Ted's headquarters were above, you know, the Fifth Avenue store. So, you know, everything was, you know, kind of emphasizing.
You get to the point of, you know, being a manager. You're now like, that's like, let's say the first step in terms of, you know, continuing your management, you know, career in retail. Where did things go after, you know, being a couple months at Ted, you know, under... now seeing that you had so much responsibility too as a manager? Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it got to a point where I think the men's manager at the time was also leaving, so I knew the opportunity for me was around the corner, and I knew what it takes. It got to a point where I think I was maybe 20. I wasn't even 21 yet, and I was gonna be, you know, the men's manager on Fifth Avenue at almost 21 or something of that end. And everything, it wasn't happening too quickly. I just thought it was very easy. And I really wanted a challenge. And, you know, I think I just didn't want to be just a manager. I wanted to oversee a lot more. And I don't want to say retail was becoming stale, but it was on a different perspective than how my mind was. Maybe I was just hungry and young and I was just working differently, but I knew that I wanted a bigger challenge. And I think that's where the restaurant industry kind of came about, you know, that 2012 year when, you know, restaurants were becoming very lively and, you know, not just restaurants, cafes, you know, they were becoming the next thing. And that's when, you know, working in Ted, you know, just helping a customer out kind of gave me the opportunity and, you know, told me, hey, do you want to run a cafe and you know, assist me in opening it, run a team. And the cafe came with a restaurant. It was kind of like a combo pack. You know, the cafe was around the corner, which is called, you know, at the time was called Why Not, you know, in Christopher and Gay Street, which is a very iconic, you know, corner, and I think in Manhattan, you know. It came with, you know, the restaurant, which is also around the corner, Olio. So it was a bonus pack of being, you know, the GM. I didn't know what being a GM really meant, you know, but that's now, because I didn't know, it's what, you know, made me even hungrier, you know. That included payroll, it included hiring now, training, you know, running a restaurant, COGS, and, you know, all these stuff that were just very interesting, or just, they kind of just gave me the pedal and said go. And that's why I, like, thrived on it, you know. I think that's how I thrive best, is when someone gives me that opportunity. And, you know, if you mess it up, you mess it up. You know, that's when you, it's on you, and you know you've done it. But I knew that when someone gives me that chance, I know I can't be stopped. And I, you know, from there, from 2012 to, you know, 2020 now, you know, 8 years has been a great journey, you know, and growing from just that little cafe on Why Not, you know, doing 150 pounds of Toby's Estate Coffee, now known as Partners. We were one of their first accounts. So that was, you know, having that relationship with such a, you know, growing company, and see, you know, Partners grow to where they are now, see where I've grown, you know, that's big for me. Yeah.
So we literally just went in one day for work and then got approached by a customer for this opportunity. And you said,
yes,
why not, without the irony
there? I just said, why, you know, you didn't even tell me the name. And I think my answer was, why not? And he was like, that's funny, because that's the name of the establishment. And, you know, I even connected obviously a lot more, but, you know, the next day I was there and it was, you know, floors and chairs and marbles, no more clothes. You know, it was designing a restaurant, and, you know, I was there in construction state. So, the first employee, and then, you know, kind of the next week there was about 20 people there working.
So what were some of the challenges just like switching over from retail to restaurants?
You know, I guess the biggest challenge you would say is close to food. You know, that's the biggest thing here, but and sanitation in general. But it was adapting. You know, you don't clean a retail store. You know, you don't mop and sweep at the end of the night, essentially. But now you got to the point where just a lot of different things of sanitation, keeping clean. You know, we live in New York, obviously, not the cleanest city in the world, but as long as your establishment was clean. So that, I think that was the biggest thing, just switching the gear of not just sales, you know.
You know, you mentioned the whole cleaning thing, which, you know, in my mind, I was like, wait a minute, like, we definitely cleaned in our store because we were so small and because we were trying to avoid, like, other expenses that probably included a cleaning staff.
Yeah, exactly,
so
yeah.
I remember, like, every morning, it was either every morning or every afternoon, too, we did it. We would, you know, vacuum the fitting rooms because the way Ted had, like the
carpet,
just the atmosphere and the environment, there was carpet in every fitting room. But yeah, I mean, I think having sanitation too, when you think about New York and restaurants, guys, what you have to remember is that, you know, there are many departments that, you know, come to visit your restaurant. So, you know, restaurants are rated and they're graded here, which I think, you know, a lot of tourists don't probably understand. They, you know, see good reviews and, you know, probably look at someone's Instagram page and go to the restaurant and don't really know how much work there is and is involved in, you know, getting a good grade. So I think that that's, you know, something again that it's worth saying that, like, you know, sanitation and just like having that, you know, running a coffee shop and having a wait staff there and cleaning up after not yourself, but cleaning up, you know, tables and stations is completely different than just, you know, cleaning up a fitting room and putting back clothes.
Sanitation is by far the number one most important key, you know, in restaurants.
So, you know, you've mentioned that you've been in the restaurant industry for the past 8 years. What type of role are you in now?
I mean, from Why Not, I worked a little bit in the Italian bistro scene, just Italian restaurants in general, and still management, store managers, GMs, but I got a side gig of being a bartender at Dudley's. It was roughly 2013 or something, or 14, I can't remember, one of those years. And I just worked the weekends. It was a Saturday, Sunday gig. I worked about, you know, brunch to a little bit of dinner. And, you know, being the bartender there and not have to worry about anything else was just the greatest kind of work. And then that just evolved. And, you know, they obviously knew who I was and what I did. And, you know, I was part of the industry too. And, you know, they kind of just proposed the offer of, well, first originally was to run Dudley's. Being the general manager at Dudley's, and now my role has evolved into being an executive manager of Wish You Were Here Group, which Dudley's is just a small entity of this big group, which contains a multitude of restaurants, you know, Dudley's obviously being one of them.
I mean, we've had a lot of guests on the podcast say that Dudley's is one of their favorite places, so I think that this is full circle that we have you on the podcast, because none of those, no one was told to say Dudley's. I think it was just really their own genuine opinions. Like, we had Alyssa on one of the episodes say that she loves, like, you know, the espresso martinis and the fries, like, calling out specific, you know, dishes from Dudley's. Is, again, nothing is sponsored here. Okay, so, like, 7 years in, you started as a bartender, so, and now you're, you know, full-time manager, really running the place. How has, like, the restaurant, not just yourself, how's the restaurant, like, evolved in the past 7 years?
The restaurant drastically, you know, it's been a wild journey, and you know, at the end of the day, it was this small little, you know, bistro or American-Australian spot on the corner of Orchard Street. You know, from the downstairs pink room, you know, that was, I guess, my first kind of project. Then it became, you know, kind of getting the spot next door, which was a gallery, and then knocking down the wall and transforming Dudley's into, you know, Dudley's what it is now, the Dudley's 2.0, essentially. And, you know, now, you know, the Dudley's Deli obviously also being there, which is now the most crucial thing for us anyways. But Dudley's seems to always keep elevating itself. And I believe that's obviously, you know, through my vision and how I've seen things of it. And that's why, you know, working so hard there just every single day and seeing people, you know, admire it. You know, I do believe that, you know, it's one of the best, you know, and, you know, very consistent restaurants in New York City. You know, it's not a Michelin star. It's not, you know, high profile. But they know that when you come there, everything from the atmosphere, the ambience, the food, the environment, the drinks, the staff, the, you know, the cleanliness, everything is there. And everything will be there, you know, every single time you go there. And I think that's why Dudley's has become such a staple to not only my friends, not only my colleagues, not only to the workers working there, not only to the staff and the people that have worked there for 4 or 5 plus years with me. You know, that just tells you a lot too in the environment that, you know, it sets there. But it really tells you on the local people that come, the people who come and eat nonstop for breakfast, meetings, a date, and then dinner, and maybe that late night cocktail at 2 in the morning. You know, we see 5-6 times a day, you know, all our locals coming in there. And that's really what Dudley's has become and, you know, is and will be and continue to grow, you know, for the Lower East Side.
Yeah, I mean, well said. I think that, you know, for anybody that's listening that doesn't know what Dudley's is, or at least where it is, not only is it just in the Lower East Side, but when you think of the Lower East Side, Delancey really splits everything in half. So you have your area where you have your rooftops, your, you know, your late night bars, and that's always like kind of really crowded, like, you know, the hair of the dog, like,
yeah, we
pianos.
It, we call it Hell Square in our kind of terminology of restaurants. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Never heard of that. But you have that area that's like, you know, so crazy. You know, it's like the livelihood of the Lower East Side. If, you know, you're especially, you know, an outsider or you're looking to go out. But then you have the opposite side of Delancey Street that has all these like small restaurants and small businesses. You know, it's from the point of the Tenement Museum to then you guys on Orchard and Broom. And then, you know, all those restaurants that follow you too. It's just like such a different, it's literally,
totally,
I believe, night and day.
It's crazy, yeah.
And, you know,
and
the fact.
The clientele too, you know, they don't cross Delancey too. You know, our people don't cross Delancey and then kind of we don't go that way. And it's crazy, you know, when you're in that corner, people, some people don't even know Dudley's. And some people in our corner don't even know, like, Hair of the Dog or, you know, No Fun or any of Sweet Chick. Like, it's ridiculous how
Sweet Chick, yeah.
People, like, don't differentiate or know because they don't go past a certain area.
Yeah.
That's just what, you know, I guess the city is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that now since, I think the renovation was last year,
yeah,
correct? And
was,
now
yeah,
your
summer, yeah.
Your restaurant has expanded. So that has also, you know, it's brought, it's been able to seat more people, but, you know, as you said, that your locals has, like, the, just the local community has definitely, you know, been the biggest, you know, kind of division of your customers.
Yeah, it definitely was. And, you know, the expansion, you know, we didn't really know, some people wanted that cute little, you know, corner spot. You know, they were very kind of, they didn't know how they were going to feel, but literally, I remember when the doors opened, people were like, I still feel like this is Dudley's. Like, you walked in and just the resemblance of the bricks, the metal, you know, yes, it was bigger, but they didn't see it as bigger being bad. It was like, great, I can actually sit down at the bar, I can sit at the table, and I can stand, you know, and still have that great experience, great menu, great drinks, great staff. And it was just, you know, from, I think, from, you know, August, from when we opened doors again to, you know, even now, it's just been a great journey, and I think there's a lot more to come to it as its own, yeah, you know, little restaurant, and, you know, just that being the one little gem of our group and, you know, my role in there.
So what are some of the fun things that you've been able to do, you know, in this role, besides obviously this renovation, which was a huge project, just having Dudley's been open, what, 8 years now
as
a restaurant,
yeah.
And having its first renovation, you know, 7 years in. What fun things have you done just with the restaurant in general and with the and your with your restaurant group?
For specifically just Dudley's, for me, you know, coming from the bar, I have a very high like bar knowledge, and I always care about everything on the menu, specifically from food to drinks. And, you know, it's very fun, and I love that the fact that still my two most popular and top selling cocktails are my cocktails that I invented, you know, couple years ago, which are, you know, the Orchard and Broom, which the name comes from where the restaurant is located. And that's kind of where it sells itself. And then, which is essentially like a blood orange margarita. It's very delicious. And then the Mint to Be being the other one, which is my very earthy, very expressive cocktail of, you know, what the area is and, you know, the way it grows on people. You know, very easy to drink, cucumber juice, vodka, you know, Saint Germain, straight to the face. And it's very pleasant to see these cocktails are still the top, you know, top two sellers every single week, you know, that we were open. And as far as the group, you know, we've done a lot of other restaurants, you know, from New York, we've done a couple more Rubies, from East Village, Murray Hill, and then, you know, going into across the, you know, the states, we've done Elefante, which is our biggest project in Santa Monica. Recently, our newest project is called the Kazi Club, which was before Goldie's, which was one of my favorite restaurants. And, you know, a lot of opportunity. I've been given the chances of opening up, you know, most of these locations as, you know, the temp GM, hiring, training, and it's just more opportunity and more caliber adding to my, you know, reservoir of things. And, you know, with that said, you know, small projects come here and there. We do Sundance Festival as a group, you know, whatever your role is, you know, essentially if you're a bartender, a cook, you know, or just, you know, whatever you can, you know, that you're representing the brand. And it's been a pleasure doing it every year now for 4 years. And small gigs here and there, you know, working for Apple or working, you know, small catering events wherever you could do. The David Zimmerman Gallery we do, which is in the 20s. I think that it's the biggest gallery in New York City. We do a lot of projects with them. And, you know, it's good to see, you know, this small, you know, restaurant just doing these big projects. You know, it just gives me a lot of joy that people give you trust and, you know, you're able to execute consistently. And you get more gigs and more gigs and more gigs and more gigs. And we're never at a point where, you know, you're refusing gigs. We try to make everything work. But, you know, it's definitely grown a lot from, you know, the small Dudley's of 2012 to what it is now. And I think, obviously, I have a big part in it.
Yeah. What things have you had to do to kind of pivot your business right now with COVID?
You know, very big thing. You know, I think the deli, which was our, you know, was our main focus before, the deli window, you know, that's our pickup takeout, which we've always had, you know, roughly it opened 2013-14. The pickup takeout window has been very crucial to our business. You know, we always had all the online platforms. We just had to, you know, kind of create this new all-day menu for everyone to be available for. But, you know, the deli window has been crucial from, you know, selling granola, selling coffee, selling, you know, liquor now, obviously, by the New York State law, and, you know, just food and just having this, like, takeout window was such a beneficial thing for all of us. It was really great to just now have time to focus on it and develop it and make it beautiful, you know. Now, if you go up to the deli window, there's, like, scales and bananas and granola, and it looks really nice and pretty. And, you know, hopefully, you know, through these rough times, this deli stays for what it is and is known for and just makes its own little business and entity. You know, we had locals swing by and say, oh my God, has this always been here? You know, yes, of course, this has been here. And, you know, it's crazy that people who live in the area didn't go to Dudley's because they knew it was such a long wait or just didn't, you know, want to bother. But now they were, you know, they see this window and, you know, I told them it's the same thing. Rather than, you know, going inside, you can just get your food in 15-20 minutes from the takeout window. You can order from your phone, you can call, everything's available. We've made it so user-friendly, contactless, you know, deliveries or pickups, whatever the case is. But, you know that we're there for our customers and we've always been there. This deli is not going anywhere. And it goes back to us being the strong, sanitary, safe haven for everyone coming in and getting fed and, you know, from all our locals.
I think that, you know, even following you guys on Instagram, you've definitely, you know, been kind of shifting the game with, you know, doing takeout drinks, takeout food, and then, you know, kind of constantly updating your community, like updating your customers online, you know, just keeping them aware, which I think, you know, kind of gives you, as I want to say, like a foot forward than, you know, the other restaurants just in the neighborhood or even, you know, just in the industry that have never really, you know, apply these business practices. Because, aside from, yes, there's all these million different, delivery platforms that you can be on, but just having, the ability to do it, which, it does suck to say, there are restaurants that, will not make it out of, this epidemic, especially because New York is just surrounded by so many of them. I was talking to someone else the other day, just saying New Yorkers are so reliant on restaurants and just establishments. You get your morning coffee somewhere. As you said,
you go to lunch, you go to a date, then you go to dinner, and then you order from your house. It's a consistent,
It's a consistent pattern for sure. I think that, it's something that we definitely choose not to have, let's say, all that space in our apartments, or, we don't have the best kitchen, or maybe even just the best skills in the kitchen. You have amazing restaurants which, it's always, is always to be said. And I think that just New York in general carries so much of the weight for not just small businesses in the restaurant industry, but in general, some of the stores that make the most money for certain brands, for certain companies, are here in New York. That's why there's, so many people live here, and there's so many, brands that have headquarters here, and, all of that. But, to speak of, you've had so much experience in this industry too, and, mentioning that you're a bartender, and we're talking about all these places in New York, I'm sure that you have, pretty high standards.
Very high. Extremely high.
When you go out. So let's say, what were some of your favorite places to eat or drink just, in New York City, when you kind of had the chance to do that?
Definitely, high standards for sure, but I still like my, not so fancy places. Like Ramona's is one of my favorite drink spots in Greenpoint. Roberta's is another spot in Brooklyn. So that's two in Brooklyn, essentially. Cafe Mogador, I love for Mediterranean food. If Kiki's, I also love, that's one of our neighbors, for Greek style as well food. It's these smaller spots that kind of touch my heart, and I think it's because I work in a little smaller industry now, of just impactful restaurants. I think those are, one of my tops. Pizza wise, I think obviously Roberta's, but I come from Brooklyn, so L&B Spumoni Gardens would have to take that slot as number one.
Yeah, I mean, well,
Spumoni. The list can go on for sure, but
I mean, give me specifics.
It's definitely like these smaller, places rather than something of a large caliber restaurant that I enjoy going to personally.
Yeah. What I think is really interesting, and I'm going to throw you on the spot right now, is that having one, not just grown up here, but being in the industry too, you've never really experienced franchise developments. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by this is you've never been to an Olive Garden. Yeah, yeah. You've never been
to
a Red Lobster.
Anything. Chili's and what else? I mean, any franchise you can think of that you've seen a TV, ad on, I have never stepped foot in. I mean, I don't want to say I don't plan to. I think you know, they will be tried one day, but I've just grown up with so much diversity of food, Greek or Mediterranean or, Chinese, Russian. It's like so much different food is around you, and, you love it. Coming from New York too, it's like, even in Brooklyn, you can go down the block and get Joe's or whatever it is, and, sushi down the block. It was so amazing that I continue to, kind of do this, pattern of eating what you want, where you want it, and how you want it.
Yeah. I think what makes it really special too is that when you live in New York, it almost feels like you can get homemade food anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not from your home necessarily, it's a restaurant. Because, when I think of growing up in Puerto Rico, if you let's say went for a nice dinner, or from what I remember, you were going to an establishment. I remember growing up, it was someone's birthday, and it was a place that a large group could gather, we would be going to the Chili's. That was, That's awesome. In the middle of both towns, and it was easy and convenient for everyone. Because, there are amazing local places. I don't want to say that Chili's is the best place, but it definitely was there and it was convenient compared to, what I consider convenient now in New York.
Yeah.
Which, again...
Everything around
Yeah. Okay, so for my final question and also my favorite part of the podcast, I ask all my guests, what do you love and what do you hate about New York?
I think my answers to this are very New York kind of answers. What I love is I love me a deli. It's not a corner store. It's not a bodega. It's called a deli, guys. Like, it is a deli. I love going to the deli, whether it's for snacks, for just a drink. And, you know, that kind of grew up on me from just being a kid and going there, you know, just for like, something sweet or something to drink. But the delis is essentially what I love about New York and having that availability of having one. You know, when I went to LA, I can't find one. You know, I had to go to Ralph's, I think, for anything that I wanted. So just having that ability on every corner was...
Or like a gas station.
Yeah, it's like, you know, and I asked someone where the deli is, and they're like, what's that? And I was like, dude, like, okay, that's when I shift gears and say corner store. And they're like, oh, I like a Ralph's? And I'm like, what's a Ralph's? And then we got to the point, like, okay, sure, Ralph's will do. But then I couldn't walk to it, which was, I guess, the part where I hate about New York is... I hate driving. You know, for me, walking, taking a train or taking a bike, I grew up on it. You know, sure, I have a license and, you know, I drive now, but, you know, getting in a car has to be for a certain reason, and it has to be for something that I can't do while walking or while on the train. Like, okay, I'm carrying this or I have to go to this event, sure, that's what I need. But I would never just take a car to just go get food or, you know, go do this when I'm just used to walking or taking a train. And I guess that's what I hate about New York is just driving, and not the concept of driving, just being a driver in New York. Love driving, I think, everywhere else, but, you know, when it's the scenery, et cetera.
You bring up an interesting point because it's funny, a lot of people that, you know, grow up in New York and live here do not have a license.
Do not have a license, yeah.
And, you know, don't plan on getting one. They don't see the purpose in it, which is true. I mean, there is, you walk everywhere, the subway is there for you, you don't necessarily need a car, which is interesting because, you know, other people grow up with the mindset of like a car is a necessity, and like for me and my family it was growing up, like it was like that's how you drove to work, that's how you got your groceries, like you, and once I had a car too, that was like a whole other... Oof. Like, you know, 16 with a car, and I'm like, oh, okay.
Dangerous.
Like, you know, basically, like, you have more of, like your daytime curfew almost of, like, when you're, you know, you're going after school, and you're like, oh, I'm going to go to the mall, or I'm going to go eat with my friends, or, like, we're going to go to the movies, and it was, like, just this escape that, like, for you know, kids in New York, it's, you're doing the same thing, but you're taking the subway.
Yeah, everywhere. And, you know, you can go from A to B, you know, like, from Coney Island to the Bronx, you know, very easily. So we never really got the concept of driving, I guess.
Well, Christian, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today. For everyone listening, whenever everything is safe and sound, go visit Dudley's. It's beautiful. If you can right now, check out the takeout window.
Yeah.
If you Google them, Google Dudley's NYC, and you can order straight from their website. So
yeah, thanks for having me as well. It's an absolute pleasure, and hope to be back here soon when more projects and developments arise. And, you know, for now, like she mentioned, you know, check us out, and hopefully I have everyone, you know, on that favorite list for, you know, all the future guests.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. For updates and behind the scenes, follow our Instagram page at Realistically with Liz. For new episodes, tune in every Saturday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.